Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. And by the sound of my voice, I am guessing you realize that I am decidedly not Bill Arnold. I am Dr. Peter Kapsner, filling in for Bill this afternoon, getting a much-deserved day off is Bill. And we are in studio here on Thursday. It's Thursday afternoon. That means it's Guy Talk. And I am sitting here across the way from Vince Miller, author and speaker. We're going to talk with Vince this afternoon about some of his book projects, as well as some issues related to Guy specifically. And, of course, my theological partner in crime, Dr. Jim Bilby, is in studio as well. And we are here for this segment to take your calls, take your questions on anything related to conversations that are important to guys. And that can be calls from women, can be calls from men, can be calls from children. Doesn't really matter. We love to get your calls into the studio at 877-933-2484. You can text the studio as well at 877-933-2484. And in just a moment, we're going to get into a conversation about competition and participation trophies. And Vince even texted me this morning about the importance of maybe avoiding trying to secure a trophy wife. And so we're going to talk about all of these topics and more next here on Afternoons with Bill Arnold.
If you know God, He can bring His grace to bear on your situation, and He can take broken things and mend them and make out of brokenness that which is beautiful. But only God can do that.
Faith Radio.
From the time you were born, you've learned to share. Share your trucks or dolls, share a dorm room, share your talents and skills, an office space, and maybe even share your life with someone. You're always sharing. As Faith Radio's Share fundraiser draws near, you have a chance to share again. Share out of the financial resources God has given you in order to share His hope and truth with the world. And this kind of sharing is not because of duty or convenience. It's out of love. If you'd like to know more, just visit myfaithradio.com.
And of course, that Nothing from Nothing music calls the great quote to mind, Jim, that you once referenced for me about the importance of having a PhD. There's something about knowing more and more about less and less. How does that quote go again?
So PhDs are people that know more and more about less and less until they know all there is to know about nothing at all.
That is the appropriateness of the music right there. Glad to be in studio with you, Jim. And Vince, as Bill is getting a well-deserved day off this afternoon. And Vince, I know, and Jim, both of you actually are in the process of writing some books. Vince, you're an author of 16 different books, actually, and you have one coming out soon. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so 20 Lessons That Build a Leader. So it's just short articles on leadership combined with kind of mentoring exercises that like a small group could use or two guys could use together.
Yep. And what do you find it would be helpful that guys would need in that kind of situation in terms of mentoring? We've talked about it a bit on these programs. And Jim, you've even referenced, I know, in the past that mentoring isn't necessarily a one-way deal. But how are you sort of approaching this, Vince?
Yeah, you know, it's creating conversation between two people, whether it be a man and another man, a woman and another woman. And, you know, I just find it very true that sometimes we're baffled about what to do. And when you put a simple guide in someone's hand, it takes all the guesswork out of it. We often self-disqualify ourselves from the task of mentoring or discipleship. But if you put a tool in someone's hand that makes it simple, they're more likely to engage, right?
Yeah, so. It sounds like it's coming in pretty much widespread in a couple of weeks for people's availability.
Yeah, about 2 weeks from now, we should have some books in stock, and so I'd be excited to put those in people's hands. So.
That's great. That's great. And Jim, you're working on an entirely different kind of topic. What are you working on?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to finish up. When I say trying to finish up, it means my deadline is April 1, and that is just right around the corner. A little scared about this, but I'm finishing up a book on salvation, which the specific topic within salvation is called The Destiny of the Unevangelized Question. So what do you do with people who have never heard the gospel, who've never even had an opportunity to hear the gospel? Somebody from Upper Mongolia in the 9th century BC, right? So there's a pretty strong sense that God from Scripture that God desires people to be in relationship with him, that he created to be in relationship with people. So that leaves us with this conundrum. What do you do with the people that apparently don't have an opportunity to hear? And so I'm advancing a particular view on that. It's actually a fairly lengthy book. My wife is on me to, as soon as I can, do a book that she calls Accessible to Real Human Beings. and I may actually do that, but this one is more of a scholarly monograph in the neighborhood of about 460 pages. So,
yeah, well, what a topic. I don't know of anybody that doesn't ask that question. I know certainly in my classes over the years that has been one of the primary, maybe top five questions that gets asked over and over again. Well, getting into some of the guy talk, I know the three of us were texting around some different topics here over the last 24, 48 hours or so. And one of the things that came up was sort of the viability of competition and whether competition should be something that we value as people and whether it's something we could engage with. And I'm curious, I mean, Vince, you have some background in collegiate football. And so you have some competition at the highest levels. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I used to be the chaplain for TCU football in the South. And man, there's a lot of competition that happens on football teams, especially in the South. It's kind of almost a worshiped entity. And I will tell you, during my tenure with that organization, I think we only lost 4 games in the years that I was there. So I saw loss very little, and I saw winning at all costs as a part of that entity. And it was interesting what people will do to get a tiny little edge up on anybody else, and the behaviors and the actions and even the compromise of our integrity at times. So yes, I don't think winning is bad, by the way, but I think that sometimes competition can draw the worst out of people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Jim, you played football here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul, correct? And a bit overseas as well, if I understand?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I mean, competition, I Vince said it really well, it draws the worst out of us. I think it can also draw the best out of us, right? If I'm playing golf and I don't care about how I'm going to score, or I'm not playing with anybody that I'm sort of have a friendly game with, it's easy to, well, I'm just going to try to, you know, hit that shot. I know I can't hit it very well. And, you know, well, I hit that bad shot, I'm just going to drop another. And you're just sort of playing. And that's interesting, and that's fun, and that's a diversion, and that's all well and good. But if I want to push myself to be better than I was yesterday, there's nothing like competition to do that. And so the trick is to figure out ways to foster competition that doesn't draw out the worst in us. And so I think there's some really interesting questions about what are the virtues of really good competition, of healthy competition, of competition that does work in this iron sharpening iron sort of mode, but doesn't become this, you know, anything, whatever lets me win mentality. And so to me, those are some really important questions for us.
So in light of that, participation trophies. I did not grow up with participation trophies. If you lost, you lost, and you sort of went home. And either one of you two, I'd be curious your sort of your thoughts on the merits of participation trophies or maybe some of the drawbacks of them. I mean, what do you think about this?
Oh, boy, this is a really tough topic, I think, because I think losing is so valuable. Right? Like, even in our spiritual life, the spiritual life is all about losing. And I don't want to give away the end, maybe, to the story, but, you know, we have to lose to gain something, right? And to learn how to lose well is a gift and an art and a blessing. And if you can't learn that when you're young by losing out or missing out on things, that teaches discipline. It teaches us patience. It teaches us to withhold ourselves from just satiating all our desires. And there's some good truth in losing sometimes. Therefore, I would say there is no situation where a participation trophy would be good for anybody, by the way. So that's just my own feelings on the topic.
You know, I mean, participation trophies are worthless. They're an embarrassment. They're a sign of the times, and you know the reason why our culture is going to hell in a handbasket, right?
Tell us how you really feel, Jim.
Very seriously, there's some real problems with the entire idea, and one of them, I mean, losing is so important, and the capacity to deal with losing and to then decide here's what I did wrong or here's what I could do better, and then get back next game and try to do better. That's so important. But in addition to that, I think what these participation trophies are is a response to the worst kind of competition. So oh, the competition, we're just going to steamroll the enemy, and then we're just going to make you feel bad after we've beaten you, you know, then, oh, okay, well, we can't let that happen. So instead of stopping the bad competition, we just try to make people feel not so bad for getting crunched, right? That's just silly, right? So that's both problematic because it's reacting to something rather than trying to articulate something that is helpful. And then it's reacting to the wrong thing. So we should improve, make our competition better so we don't have to be giving participation trophies.
Yeah, that's something really well said. And I like the way that you said it. We're trying to avoid these bad feelings or these bad experiences, right?
Yeah.
But Jim, to add to that too, I think that it's really interesting to lose and to learn something,
yeah.
Right? Like businesses do this all the time. We're talking about sports right now, but like in business, you learn hard lessons by losing, right? And businesses lose all the time. And in capitalism, we learn to lose and then other people learn to win. And you're trying to beat other businesses or other competitors in your market. You learn great lessons, right? By losing something, you learn another way not to do it. And people who become resilient in that way get smarter every single time. We can't avoid those feelings or those experiences.
Yeah.
Jim, most important thing you've ever learned from losing something?
Oh, my goodness. You know what? I remember, I was a little kid. I was pretty short growing up. And so I'd play basketball and I was nowhere near as good as people. And, I had a coach tell me one time when I was feeling really bad about kind of been embarrassed in a game. He was like, well, you can keep doing what you're trying to do, which is try to be taller than everybody, or you can do something they can't do, which is to be quicker than everybody. And so the failure then asks, okay, so if I can't do that, what can I do? And that lesson, I think, has been a crucial life lesson for so many different areas of my life.
Vince, we'll go to break here in just a minute, but when we come back, I'm intrigued by something you said, which is what we learn even in the spiritual realm by losing, and what an invitation that is for us in our discipleship journey and in our growth. So we're taking your calls, too, this afternoon as part of our Guy Talk segment. You can call and text the studio at 877-933-2484. The guys are willing to take on any topic you might want to call or text. More in a moment here on Afternoons with Bill Arnold. About 18 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I'm your substitute host this afternoon, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Delighted to be joined in studio by friends Vince Miller and Dr. Jim Bilby as part of Guy Talk. We're talking competition and trophies and winning and losing and what we can learn in so many of those different kinds of realities of our life. If you want to join the conversation with this kind of topic or really any topic you'd like to see us address this afternoon, you can call or text at 877-933-2484. We'd love to hear from you. And Vince, before in this opening segment, obviously, we've been addressing competition from maybe a business standpoint or perhaps a sports standpoint, but you made a pretty intriguing reference to the idea of losing spiritually on some level. And I don't know, in most of the Christian communities I find myself in, we're mostly busy trying to put on happy faces to avoid the fact that we really might be losing in some way, shape, or form in our spirituality. So say more about that.
Yeah, you know, I think our spiritual life begins with loss. A lot of it, the whole thing, right? And we have to really come face to face with personal sin, that when we compete with sin, we lose every time, right? And we come to the end of ourselves. We actually say that. We come to the end of ourselves. That's a big L, all right? We lost. And then when we discover that, we discover that Christ won for us. He's the one actually competing for us because we didn't even deserve to play on the field, by the way, which is so ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so he wins for us because we can't win for ourselves. And I don't understand why we're so embarrassed and ashamed of this all the time. Like, you know, I was sitting down with a friend this morning and I was sharing with him about, like, my own concerns about losing at times, and not just about loss, but about losing ownership in something is what I was talking with about. And it was weird, all these feelings that kind of came out as I was sharing that. I was like, man, I'm having a hard time talking with him about this right now because I'm scared of what that other person might think or what might happen. Those were the two things, what he might think and what might happen. So I think we're actually scared of loss, even though we had to learn to lose to begin with, right?
No, I mean, I think the very question of losing in our faith, from a, you could say from a scriptural mindset, what what accounts as salvation or what counts as us accepting God's grace is losing in the worst possible way in the eyes of the culture, right? The gospel is foolishness in the eyes of the culture, because the whole idea of I can't do it myself and I am going to, you know, get on my knees and take accept a, you know, a gift that I can't possibly earn is just, again, it's ludicrous in the eyes of our culture. And so I think it's crucial to acknowledge that, because when it comes right down to it, salvation is something you can't possibly earn. You can't possibly deserve. I can't possibly be a good enough person to deserve what Christ did for me on the cross. And what that does is it doesn't take away the concept of striving, right? It doesn't take away the, my responsibility to still follow Christ in the best possible way. But what it does is it relocates the concept away from salvation is not something I can earn, but because I can't earn it, now I'm going to do everything I can do to follow Christ, who's, you know, the author and perfecter of my faith, of salvation.
It's interesting, Jeremy, you reference what you learned from losing in basketball a bit, just being shorter maybe than everybody else, that there's this invitation to figure out, well, then how could you win in the face of losing? Is what could you do to then win? And I'm hearing something different in the invitation of our spiritual losingness. It's not figure out, well, I've been a loser in this way, I'll figure out how to win. It sounds like it's more of an invitation to dependence then, which is not something that we learn in American kind of competition, which is once we lose, we figure out we're going to do this better, smarter, faster, stronger so we can win. And yet the loser part of the spirituality invites us not to that, but to dependence.
Well, and the funny thing about this whole thing is the motivation behind it, right? The motivation pre-Christ is to win for our own purposes, our own reason, to conquer somebody else so that we can win and they will lose, right? But when we come to Christ, like Jim is talking about here, and I think the doctor's right, because he's suggesting that, well, now just because Christ has won for us, that doesn't make us a loser in the essence of our identity. It makes us a winner in our identity. Therefore, we extend out of the motivation of love all this effort, right? Because Christ has won for us a crown that we receive. Here's all this athletic metaphors that come out of Paul's writing, right? We get to receive a crown that was won for us by somebody else, but we wear it with pride, not arrogance, pride, out of the fact that we're going to strive and strive and strive and run hard for the rest of our lives.
What, in terms of our faith, how does it help inform our present to know that there is future victory, that the winning is actually assured? I've never played in a competitive event where the winning was absolutely assured in that situation. But we learn from the book of Revelation, for example, that the end of the story is revealed for us. And so as we're living out life, how does that impact our life today to know the end of the story, that there is a victory at the end of this deal?
Well, Peter, that raises to me, I think, a really complicated question. So, I mean, the victory is assured for Christ, right? But does that mean the victory is assured for every single individual person? Well, not obviously. It seems possible that there'll be people on this planet that will say no to God, and by virtue of that, take the ultimate L, right? They will fail to accept the offer of salvation that God gives. And unfortunately, it seems possible that there are even some people who call themselves Christians at some times in their lives that will fail to understand what it really means to follow Jesus Christ. And there's all sorts of layers of questions there. Are you saying you can lose your salvation? There are people, no. If you walk away, you never had it at the beginning. So there's all these conversations that, you know, probably we don't have to get into. But it seems very possible that you can, even though Christ is victor, it's possible for us to use the metaphor from Ephesians and other places, for us to not be in Christ and therefore not to experience victory.
Yeah, you know, the story I think about in the Bible that's probably the simplest that gets after this issue is David and Goliath. I think about this all the time, but David runs into the battle as if he's already won, right? Because he knows that there's a giant God running behind him. And he knows that he's not fighting the battle, God is. But the reality is that he's surrounded by a bunch of losers. I mean, really, right. The people who have mentally vacated the battle, even his own relatives, yet he runs into that thing, small, tiny man against a 9-foot-tall guy with a few stones. It sinks him into his head, but the funny thing is the sword that he was called to use was out there, and he had to go get it. So he had to run out there and go get it, and I think that's very depictive of the spiritual life. I wouldn't take this completely metaphorically because it was an actual story, and it really did happen, but there's something about this moment that's indicative of how we should live life, and I think that's why we look at David and are entranced by his courage and faith in God.
talking about losing and what we can learn from losing in this, but are there things we can learn from winning as well? It's something we don't maybe talk as much about, but I think about one of my favorite Little League coaches that I worked with. He was the first coach that my son had when he was about 6 or 7 years old. And he was going through that typical sort of speech at the start of a season. It doesn't matter if you win or lose or something along those lines. But then he made a statement that I'll never forget. And he looked at the team and he said, but winning is funner. And I thought, huh, that was an interesting statement to wonder, are there things that we learn, are there things we experience in winning that really do set apart and a reason to pursue it?
So I think there absolutely are. And so you could say, well, you learned such great lessons from losing. Yeah, but I also learned really good lessons from winning as well. And so what do you learn from winning? Obviously, when you've put in the time and you've done the work. So it's completely different if you just win and it's a fluke, right? Nobody feels good about that. A person losing doesn't feel good about it. The person winning doesn't feel good about it. But if you've put in the time and if you've done the work and then the result is, wow, that really made a difference, whether it be on, you know, athletic field or whether it be in your spiritual life, that's those sorts of successes cement the path that you took to get there in such important ways.
Okay, so I'm going to be a little bit controversial, and maybe you want to talk about more of this, but I don't think men are as competitive as we think they are. After about the age of 25, I think we start to lose our desire to compete. Now, there's all kinds of reasons for that. But the funny thing about what you're talking about the lessons that we learn, I'm actually learning them vicariously through my children. So I've had 3 children. One's in college, one's about to leave to go to college, and one's in high school. They all played sports, and I found myself living competitively and vicariously through them as I watched them play sports. And I ask myself, are there lessons that we can learn from winning and losing as a parent on the sideline? That gets really interesting, doesn't it? Because all of a sudden, there's this animal instinct that comes out of me that I remember when I was a child playing competitive sports. It's fascinating, isn't it, that this thing comes out of us whether we win or we lose. And I have listened to parents cheer aggressively as a team wins 10-0 against another team. And I've seen parents get aggressive and mean and vicious towards kids when they're losing or they feel that the field of sport is being reffed unfairly. So it just brings out all this interesting stuff and lessons we can learn, not just as kids, but as adults.
Seems to speak to the idea that we might say that it doesn't matter if you win or lose, but boy, when brass tacks hit, it sure seems to matter on about every possible level, doesn't it?
Every possible way. You tell kids we're not keeping score here, that's baloney. They're all keeping score. We all know that. So actually, I would love it if we would just stop doing that, because if a 4-year-old and you're like, oh, we're not keeping score here, if they know we're keeping score, then you're not fooling anybody.
Yeah, I remember we were doing a fall ball. It was kind of a practice league for a Little League, and it was supposed to be a time where the scoreboards were off. It was just a practice time. The kids were just learning. It was developmental. We got to about inning 3, and every kid on the dugout bench that I was coaching at that point was saying, Kapsner, what's the score? Coach Kapsner, what's the score? What do we know from that? There is something about learning in the winning and losing, and I think kids are not fooled by the participation trophy at the end of the day. That's first half of this first segment with Guy Talk. We'd love to hear from you. We got some texts coming in and some calls. We'll take your calls and questions here next as we come back from break on Guy Talk on Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Welcome back to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I'm your host for the day as Bill is getting a well-deserved break. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Dr. Jim Bilby and Vince Miller as part of our Guy Talk segment here on Thursday afternoons. And Jim, we'll get back to this conversation on competition and winning and losing and trophies and all of that in just a minute. But you came into the studio this afternoon. You said, you know, it'd be interesting to have a conversation on the morality of speeding. And Jim, I understand you to be a person that when it says 55, you are dead on 55. Cruise control, you do not even waver or deviate from that number. Is that correct?
Well, you know, when you reach the sort of higher spiritual status that I have, actually, to be perfectly honest, I mean, it's embarrassing. I'm not sure, and this is why I think it's an important question. It's an interesting question. I'm not even sure I even try to avoid speeding now. I mean, so there's the goal. It's 55. I go 55. I'm not sure I even ask myself. I think I say, how fast can I go? And then it's nothing to do with 55. It has to do with, you know, road conditions or whether there's likely to be a cop following me or something like that. And that's a real question. Should I feel bad about that? Peter, what do you think?
That's a great question. I'll ask Vince a similar kind of question. It's kind of dodge and deflect and duck in this one. Vince, you're let's say you're rural Minnesota somewhere, and there's a stoplight, and there's a left turn signal that says distinctly red, but you can see for miles and miles and miles, and there's nobody coming, and you'd like to get home on time, you know, for whatever the event is. Do you take a left on that red, Vince?
Oh, man, I don't know. How many times have I come up to a stop sign in the winter here when I know I'm going to slide and just go on and drive through it, and I don't feel bad ever.
Yeah.
Or how many times on that stretch of 35 over here by the hospital on 35E have you gone actually 35 on that stretch of freeway? Never. No. Jim has never done that.
No.
So no, I would probably go ahead and make the left turn, unfortunately.
Well, this sounds like a good conversation for Bill. We'll throw him under the bus, and he can address this next week. But getting back a bit into the competition, some interesting texts have come in, you guys, and thinking about some different angles of this beyond just sort of sports and free market enterprise in the business place. We've got a text from a listener in Scotland, actually, who says that she is way more competitive than her husband. Is it because she grew up with boys? Is this competition stuff? Is it nature or is it nurture?
Well, doesn't it have to be both, right? I mean, my default answer to the nature-nurture question is it's got to be both. But in which is it? I mean, I think there is definitely a growing up with boys. There's something that is unique there. I think that does affect things. But I think you can ask some pretty interesting questions just about the base. Our assumption might be that women aren't. You know, girls aren't competitive. And I'm not sure that's entirely true.
I agree with that. I think actually girls are very competitive. And I think usually after marriage, they get much more competitive, especially in this comparison game between them, other women, how they dress, how they look, what kind of homes they live in, the things that they do. It's weird. I actually think men are less competitive on those things, personally. That's just a personal opinion. You can, have a different opinion, Jim. I think you do.
No, actually. So, I mean, on those things, I think it's probably right. I think that, but I'm not entirely sure that it means that I'm not competitive when it comes to how my house looks, because I just might be oblivious, right? I might be completely unaware that there's even a game to be played. If I'm aware of a game to be played, then I'm going to throw myself into it, but I'm just oblivious of, and you know, I always tell my wife, never underestimate my ability to be oblivious about things. And that would be one of them. I don't even think in those terms of my house needs to look this way, so somebody else needs house, you know, or somebody else's house looks away, so I need to have something similar.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, you've got a boy who is playing football right now. You also have a girl playing competitive soccer. Do you notice differences between the two of them? I mean, they're playing at kind of that high school level, and the competition is pretty extreme in both situations. Do you notice differences?
No, I don't think there are differences in the underlying competition. There are wild differences in how that gets played out and what it looks like. And boys are competitive in a more verbal way, in a more sort of intensely personal, I'm going to crush you, whether it's, you're really serious and you're like, you know, wanting to crush somebody, or whether it's a fun thing between friends. Guys are much more intensely competitive in some ways. But my youngest daughter is intensely competitive and really works at her craft of playing soccer. And she is very driven, but it looks very different from the outside, and you know, there's not the sort of same, I think the same need to kind of like, I'm not only going to win, I'm going to crush the person or something like that.
Vince, you and your wife competitive? You ever play games?
Oh yeah, we are competitive with each other. She would say I'm far more competitive, but you know, it's funny, like she has got me into doing things that are competitive, and sometimes I will exceed her ability, and sometimes she will exceed mine, and it's just interesting how I experience that, right? It's brings out something in me that sometimes I don't like, but you know, we're very competitive people with each other. Our entire family is competitive, actually.
So, and Jim, when you play maybe team games against another couple or something like that, you and Michelle partners, or are you better off on other teams?
No, we can be partners for sure. I mean, we do a couples golf league, and that's, it's a really fun time. It is also a competitive sort of thing. I've noticed there that I'm generally more aware of what the current score is and how we're doing, and my wife is a little bit more on the, hey, this is, we're just having fun here. So there are times like, hey, no, we need to buckle down here. We need to finish strong because we have a good chance of putting in a good score. And so I think there are some differences there. We do fine competing together. We don't do as well when we're playing, say, cribbage against each other. She just doesn't like that because...
You win?
Yeah. well, she doesn't... When I lose, I'm like, oh, that's fun. Let's play again. And because then I want to, like, win. When she loses, she's like, that wasn't fun.
Vince, the things you learned about your marriage, even about each other in a relationship when you're in active competition, either with or against each other?
Oh, absolutely. And it's hard for me because I think there are definitive times that I actually do lose. And so that's an interesting dynamic. You should see our family at the dinner table. It's quite interesting because we're all about the same. And most people would call it yelling. We are just kind of vying for voice all the time. And it's just interesting how we go about it. I think if we had a spectator in our house at dinner time, they'd be like, man, that was weird. Like, that was a very interesting way that we kind of come together. But we're all competing and vying all the time. And I don't know if it's healthy sometimes or if it's unhealthy. I really don't know. But I can see out of my children with their relationships in life that they do naturally compete because of that. And we have learned some really neat lessons from it.
Rebecca, Rebecca Maxwell, producer in studio here, and interesting text from a listener as well. And we're talking just there's different forms of competition here in family competition. There's sports, there's business, but interesting text from a listener. Tell us about this one.
Yes, a listener, and I'm not sure if it's a male or female, but valued listener, do you think that men compare their looks as much as women do? They work in with eating disorders, and the majority of people they see are women, but still they can't help but think that men actually struggle with physical comparisons as well. So inviting the guys' thoughts on that.
Well, I think there's a certain sort of awareness of appearance. But again, I'm thinking even back in the day when I think I cared more about what I look, I obviously don't care what I look like these days very much. But back in the day when I did care, it wasn't probably to the same degree as my friends that were women. And I didn't care about as much of stuff, right? I mean, so, you know, I was in college, I was doing everything I do to gain weight because I was playing football and, you know, I wanted to be at this weight and, you know, so I'm eating everything all the time. And so that's just that's a completely different sort of thing. It's, you know, it's more okay for a guy to gain weight. And, you know, and so I don't know. So I think there's so much there that we are, that guys are aware of, but it does not seem to me to be anywhere near the same degree of intensity. And it doesn't have the same breadth. We don't worry about as many things.
I totally agree with that. I think it's funny. You have to actually teach a guy how to groom himself, right? Like, you have to actually teach those things. Yeah. Women almost intuitively know how to groom themselves based upon how they look at other women. I mean, seriously. And just talk to a first-year college student. He doesn't wash his sheets for an entire semester until his mom does it for him. Does he care about his personal hygiene or how he looks? Most of the time, he doesn't even think about it, I think, sometimes. Now, this isn't true for every guy, but if I was taking a poll, I would generally say men care less about how they look, about 25% more or less than a woman does.
And Rebecca, there was an epiphany I had when I first got married, and that was that going out to parties, I had no idea that when women are getting dressed up, it's not typically for the guys in the party. It tends to be a pretty competitive thing among women in terms of their comparing themselves to one another, even at parties like this.
Right. And that's, I think, an interesting difference between competition and comparison. Maybe men are more competitive and women are more comparative. I don't know. Maybe it feels like the contest is never over if you're always judging against somebody else as the standard. If you have an objective standard, then you know, okay, win or lose, it's based on who did this, who had the most scores, who went the farthest, the fastest, etc. But if there's always some other person and that other person becomes the standard, then there's always a comparison game to be played. And I don't think that's healthy.
Are you saying that my wife gets dressed up for other women, not me? I'm just now learning this thing. Is this I'm going to have a talk with her when we get home.
Vince, this is true. I'm sorry to tell you this. I think Rebecca raises a great point there. I think with respect to guys, there's a difference between internal competitiveness and external competitiveness. So, I mean, let's say I go play disc golf with a really good friend of mine, and he's a really good disc golfer, and I beat him, but we both play the worst rounds of the year. Am I feeling good about that? No, not at all. So externally, I beat him. I won, but because I played so poorly, I'm not at all happy, right? I would rather lose to my friend by, you know, a couple of strokes and have us both have amazing rounds than win in sort of some sort of external way. So for me these days, I've tried to funnel as much of my competitive juices as I can into internal competitiveness, trying to make whatever it is that I'm doing better, you know, today than I was yesterday, rather than just, you know, beating somebody, you know, even if it means that I'm not doing very well.
Yeah, and there's, you know, this comparative that you referenced, Rebecca, just in terms of how women are maybe comparing themselves against each other. Vince, is there an invitation for guys to help in this situation to some degree? Because I would think that this is, if you're always in this comparative mindset, can you kind of have the relationship as a married couple in which this comparative is no longer in play, where the woman is assured that there isn't any competition happening? We reference this idea of trophy wives at the top of the show. We can get into that further about what gets underneath all of that. But it seems like there might be an invitation to think about how can there be a lack of comparative in the marriage relationship so you really only do see each other in this.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, Rebecca got after this, and I really appreciate her mentioning the comparative piece. But I think the comparative piece is actually good, right? We were only seeing the evil in it sometimes, but to compare ourselves with ourselves is not healthy. To compare ourselves with what God says about us actually drives us toward greater health. And so we need some comparative analysis. We need to be using logic and understanding. We need to be judging, but not be judgmental. We need to be comparative, but not competing for the sake of somebody else's loss. So we need to engage in the conversation and have it. And we probably need to be having it with our kids. We probably need to be having it with our spouse as well. And they need to be having it with me as a man of God as well. Like, you are a great man, leader, father, and she is a great mother. Mother, woman, beautiful, dearly, and wonderfully made. And son, you lost the game. Daughter, you lost the game, but I loved watching you play. Right? These are amazing lessons that we all need to teach along the way.
Yeah, sounds like a bit of an invitation to a both and in that, to acknowledge the competitiveness, but not to just give it a participation trophy to try to cover the ill of it. Well, more to come here on Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Take a short break and come back. We have one more segment left. We'd love to get some more texts and calls from you. I know we got a few more to get to here, gentlemen, if you're up for it. And so still time to call or text the studio at 877-933-2484. More to come with Jim and Vince in studio here on Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Welcome back to the show. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, filling in for Bill Arnold this afternoon, having the Guy Talk segment that we have on Thursday afternoons with Dr. Jim Bilby and Vince Miller in studio. And we were talking to a gentleman before the break a little bit about what it means to be in a relationship with your spouse and have a situation where maybe your wife is feeling a bit of the comparative pressures with some of the other women around her. Is it a romantic notion? Is it just sort of foolishness to think that two people in a relationship could just have eyes only for one another, where the comparative nature of that is just out of play?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that's it's really tough. So there's an ideal there that, oh, sure, the only thing I care about is what my wife thinks about, and the only thing she cares about is what I think about her. And I think that's one of those ideals that I'm not sure is really reachable. And so sometimes you say, well, you strive for it anyway, but I'm not sure if that's so impossible to reach. I'm not sure maybe it's a helpful thing to express as a goal. And part of that is because my wife is so different than I. We're wired so differently with respect to these things. And so she can put on like this whole array. Let's say we're going out for the, she can put on, you know, a whole array of things. And I'm like, yeah, all of them, that's great. All of it's great. And so I don't draw the sort of distinctions between, well, that dress is a little better than that dress, or, you know, and I just don't engage at that level. And so for her to only care about what I think, I might not have enough of an opinion to help her, even understand or think better. And so it might be a good thing if she looks at other people or has cares about the opinions of other people that might care a little bit more or might know a little bit more. So I can imagine that a situation like that could be a helpful sort of thing.
Yeah, so me and my wife actually have some of these conversations. Maybe we're a little bit odd or weird, but I'll from time to time tell her, wow, I think that person there is very beautiful, or I admire their beauty, or there's something about what they're wearing that's, you know, gorgeous, and I'll share it with her, and she'll do the same with me. And we were on vacation together, and we noticed something, and we both said, boy, we both found that very attractive. And I think it's interesting the way we look at these things and we talk and dialogue about them, because they draw something emotionally out of both of us on what we admire. And everybody sees beauty differently, right? Like, you're going to see beauty differently than Jim is going to see beauty, and Bob, who's the show host, right? Or Bill, whatever his name is, he's not here, but, you know, he's a great guy, but, right? I'm never going to be invited back again, right? So, and he's going to see beauty differently than we see it. And that's what makes beauty so different and relevant to each person. And I think we should be talking about that and admire it. To only have eyes for my wife, I wonder what that really means. Like, you know, it's such a strange verbiage. Is it physical? Is it emotional? Is it spiritual? What does that mean? And what are the things that we find attractive in life?
Yeah, I think it's crucial to, when we say, I only have eyes for my wife, that the most sensible way of understanding that is that ultimately her opinion is the one that matters the most to me, that ultimately, even if I, you know, see somebody else and I find them to be attractive in one shape, way, or form, that's merely an acknowledgement of fact. It's not an acknowledgement of heart connection or anything like that. So, but the idea that I only have eyes for, meaning I don't even pay attention to anybody else's opinion, that seems impossible, or seems at least difficult.
Is there something that we're missing or maybe need to attend to in some of this, that to speak to this sort of sociological phenomenon of men wanting to secure somebody who is younger or in their mind prettier or something? This is the trophy wife conversation, Vince, that we were texting about that we just don't talk about much. I haven't heard a sermon about trophy wives before. It doesn't come up in the church very often. And so this is hard. I mean, are men just sort of dealing with these ideas that they're getting older and they're running into their limitations and they sort of want to recapture something? Is there almost an internal competitiveness? I mean, what's underneath all of this that may take them in a very disordered way away from the invitation to their spouse?
Yeah, I think that's the word disordered is key, what you said there. We have these ideas, I think, that we often over-romanticize marriage, right? We over-romanticize relationships, and then we think about them as if we've arrived. And to me, this whole idea of trophy wife is much more condescending than we can imagine. Now, we all want our wives probably want us to think that they are a trophy, but not something to be gained and accomplished and owned and possessed, right? And by the way, when we get married, it isn't the end of our relationship or our pursuit. It's actually the beginning of a pursuit. So, you know, if you really want to think trophy, it's way out there. The win is commitment to one another. It's not to have arrived and to accomplish something. And I just don't even like the image or the language of trophy wife. It's to say something very condescending about how I think about marriage in its essence and core. It's far more beautiful than that, and it means far more to each of us than that.
Yeah, and I think the difficult thing there is when a person has this kind of concept of trophy wife, we're just grabbing onto the cultural fascination with youth and perpetual youth and everything you're doing. You're trying to make yourself look young again. And so, you know, you're going to, you know, you're an older man. Oh, you know, I'm going to, you know, find, you know, a young, beautiful trophy wife. And there's so much with this idea of youth that we're trying to find this perpetual youth that I think is just flawed in our culture. It's dangerous. We're trying to run away from first reality, because nobody's going to defeat aging. Nobody. I don't care what medical discovery, what cream you can put on your face. None of that is actually going to really work in any sort of real way. And so first, it's, you know, lying to yourself. And second, it's not identifying the things that are most important. Other cultures that don't have our fixation with youth tend to emphasize wisdom,
yes,
and experience and virtues like that honestly are far better connected to the core concepts of the gospel of Jesus Christ than our fixation with youth and vitality and things like that.
I was actually just thinking about that, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think if you even just step back into time, there was something special about being a man of age, of wisdom, with some gray hair, right? Yeah. You had to wait to earn the beauty and the honor of those moments. And we have completely lost that. In fact, I know many people that sit around at the age of 70 thinking they've come to the end of their life. And I'm going, dude, I have so much to learn from you because of your wisdom and your experience. And they don't see themselves in that light anymore. I think predominantly because the culture is screaming so loudly about what is beautiful and youth is considered beautiful, right?
So as the physical deterioration hits in a relationship, and you know maybe you're married for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, you're getting into your 80s and 90s, can you fall more deeply in love with your spouse in the midst of really significant physical deterioration happening?
I would hope so.
Yeah, it has to, right? If we buy the idea that love is not just this sexual attraction, not just this erotic level thing, and if love is something that is much more than just appreciating the beauty of somebody, then you'd have to be the case that as you get to know somebody better, and let's be honest, we all do. I've been married for almost 25 years. I understand my wife better now than I did when we were married 10 years and better then than 5 years. And I'm sure I will understand her better and value her even more than I do now when we've been married for 40 years. And that's just the way it is. That's the nature of a relationship. That's we're in a relationship with a subject, not an object. And so there's super always good. That evolving and growing thing. And of course, then the longer you've been together, there's an appreciation of the person that is grows so much greater through just all the different things that you've done, through raising a family together, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, absolutely. That's let's be honest, that's the joy.
Yeah.
That's what's awesome about it. What's awesome about it is not just looking good together for a couple of years in your 20s. What's awesome is the through the years and through the difficulties and through the tears even that you've been side by side and you're continuing to be side by side. And that's what's awesome.
Yeah. Talk to any couple who's been married 50 years or more. Talk to them. They will tell you usually about a 5-year period of time or more sometimes where they thought they weren't going to make it. Yet they stayed committed to one another through those hard, difficult times. And because of that, they experience more joy and love. And it's almost indescribable. If you look in their eyes, they're struggling to like tell you in your 20s and your 30s, like it's going to be awesome. Just stick with it. Stay committed. Love, not just transactionally or sexually. Love more fully than that and look beyond it. And I got to tell you, I look at these couples and I go, you are amazing, but I can't articulate it. And we won't know until we get there, right?
Yeah. I think it's fascinating how often older couples, and they've been on the journey for 50 or 60 years together, if one of them does pass away, how quickly, so often, that it's not all the time, but boy, so often, there's such a shared experience of sort of being tied together in the beauty and wonder of the journey that 3 months later, and it's not necessarily just even giving up, it really can be, there can be a broken heart, right?
Yeah, literally. There's so much. I mean, I was just talking with my daughter today about when bad things come into our lives and what's required for us when something bad happens like that is we need to tell a new story that sort of it takes everything that we've already known and then integrates this new thing into that, right? But for a couple that's been, they've been married for 60 years, what story do you tell now that says, oh, now this is why I move on? And because they're literally their entire life, you know, everything about that was that person. And so I just think there is a loss of meaning at a profound level that calls people to or just, you know, leaves them with a sense of, yeah, well, I don't need to move on now. I'm fine. I've had however many years. So I think that's, you know, unfortunately the case.
Yeah, my grandparents raised me. My grandfather was the first to die, and actually my grandmother lived for about 15 more years after him. She died when she was 98. Mm. And I just watched loneliness enter her life as not only her brothers and sisters all died, but all of her friends. And at the end of it all, she stopped eating, and it was really quite sobering. She's such a healthy person. But I saw loneliness break her heart is what I saw. And I think that there's something about this deep and loving relationship that goes far beyond just a physical transaction. It is indescribable.
Well, Jim and Vince, thanks as always for joining us here on a Thursday afternoon like this. We did get a text from a listener named Bill wondering when Bill is going to be back on the show. I'm a little bit suspicious, gentlemen. I don't know about the two of you where that text is coming from.
I think your suspicions are really justified.
Yeah.
Have a great afternoon, you guys. We've got hour two coming up here on Afternoons with Bill Arnold. We'll be joined on Deep Thinker Thursday next with good friends John and Pam Bloom. And we're going to talk a little bit about getting through bitterness in life.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.